me dry. There was so much water, I couldn't believe my eyes. And I was worried about my family, will they be alright? Will they make it on the I-2 for another night? Oh, people thirsty, dying by the roadside. Oh, and jumping off the bridge, committing suicide. Babies crying, mama.
Many nations around the world have incorporated human rights provisions into their legal framework and now provide more basic rights to their people than the United States. In key instances, international human rights standards are broader and more protective than the U.S. Constitution or domestic civil rights laws. At this moment in history, the notion of applying a universal human rights framework to the United States seems to be striking a chord with activists around the country.
What do we want?
Human rights!
Where do we want it?
Now!
I think human rights are important, especially for young people, because it shows how people that don't know their human rights are being violated every day. Young people should also get involved in the human rights because you don't have to be an adult to change the world.
Instead of you, we speak the truth. Instead of you, we speak the truth.
Now, this is Ajamu Baraka, Executive Director of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and you're listening to No Retreat, No Compromise.
And welcome to the second podcast of the U.S. Human Rights Network. I am your host, Ajamu Baraka, Director of the U.S. Human Rights Network. We have a very interesting show today. We're going to be talking about the intersectional framework and its relationship to the human rights framework. We have with us Tonda Bantu Iverson, who is a professor of labor studies from Indiana University. We have an audio clip from Priscilla Wong, who is the director of the National Asian Pacific Women's Forum, taken from a presentation she made at the U.S. Human Rights Network's National Conference back in April of 2008. And follow that, we're going to have a conversation with Radhika Balakrishna, who is a professor of economics and international studies at Marymount Manhattan College, who's going to talk about the implications, the human rights implications of this financial meltdown we've observed over the last week and a half.
So we're all here today because we believe, you know, the power of the human rights framework. We believe in its universality and its power, potential to empower and mobilize our communities. A human rights framework speaks to the need to demand rights and the need to connect with people and struggles globally. It also highlights the government's role and responsibility in committing human rights abuses. We all know that the U.S. government is one of the greatest perpetrators of human rights violations, particularly when it comes to politically and socially disenfranchised groups. We also know that our experiences and our identities are not singular, that many of us experience multiple forms of discrimination and oppression due to our multiple identities. So my organization, the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum, or NAPOF for short, was born out of the recognition that our identities cannot be separated and that our issues cannot be treated in isolation. We formed after a group of Asian American and Pacific Islander women activists met in 1995 at the 4th UN World Conference on Women in Beijing, China. They were amazed that it took a trip to the other side of the world to meet each other, many for the first time. But they all agreed that it was their belief in human rights that brought them together, and they vowed to do something about it when they returned. Although our work is focused in the United States, we are the only national membership-based multi-issue women of color organization in the country, and to me that's pretty revolutionary. We've learned a few lessons about building a Asian and Pacific Islander women's centered movement, and I know we'll stumble through many, many more lessons, but I thought I'd share with you three strategies that our founding sisters, as we call them, had the wisdom to institutionalize from our organization's beginning, which are strategies that I think we can all use to engage in cross-movement work and in cross-border work. First, they created a people-centered organization. That sounds pretty obvious to people in this room, but as a policy organization that also has an office in Washington, D.C., there are a lot of policy organizations that we work with who do not have a membership base. And, you know, NAPOF was also, in the first 7 years of our existence, completely driven by the passion and energies of our volunteers. Our founding sisters believed in people power. They also believed in the power of creating spaces for us to meet. That might also sound like a simple task, but our founding sisters called us a forum for a reason. As Asian and Pacific Islander women in the United States, we constitute a very small segment of the general population. Many of us were also raised in households where the cultural norms discouraged mothers and daughters from speaking their minds. Thus, as women who are often invisible in the public and within our own communities, creating spaces for us to come together and to be seen and to be heard was really central to our movement building efforts. For myself, this is what brought me to NAPOF. I was a member before I joined as staff, and it was because I had a history of working in self-identified feminists and social justice organizations, and I was tired of not being heard in those circles. So second, our founding sisters created a pan-ethnic organization, and they did this as a strategy for building power. Pan-ethnic organizing is not easy, but it's necessary. Especially when you're a small constituency in the United States. The Asian and Pacific Islander communities comprise of over 30 ethnic identities and just as many languages. Many of these ethnic groups also carry with them the memory of centuries-long interregional conflicts that continue to mark even new generations with historical scars. So many, moreover, in the United States, the API community is often portrayed in the media and touted by policymakers as the model minority, which is a tactic that we know is meant to divide and conquer communities of color. Pan-ethnic organizing has definitely been a challenge, but it's something we continue to struggle with today. And we do it because we see the commonalities of our struggles. Third, our founding sisters created a multi-issue organization. This is particularly important strategy because multi-issue organizing is about survival. We do not live our lives one issue at a time. Therefore, it doesn't make sense to advocate for ourselves one issue at a time. And as women, I think every person, woman in here will know that, you know, we are the child rearers, we're the child bearers, we're the breadwinners, we're the housekeepers, we're the economic planners and the decision makers of our families. And so there's no time of day when we're not multi-issue organizing in our own personal lives. And so, because we recognize that we are women struggling to survive in a society that is still dominated by racist, classist, and sexist systems of values and laws, and because our black, brown, white, red, and yellow bodies have and continue to be targets for unequal treatment, violence, abuse, commodification, and reproduction, both forced and oppressed, we recognize that women's rights our human rights, and that our struggles in the U.S. parallel the struggles of women internationally. But before I close, let me say that I think if we want to engage in cross-movement building work and cross-border work, we need to abide by what I call the Hippocratic Oath approach, do no harm. This is especially true when we recognize that U.S. foreign policies are literally killing people abroad. And so we must demand accountability from our government because our sisters and brothers in the global community cannot. So I think my time is up. So I'll end there.
And we're here with Tonda Bantu Iverson, professor of labor studies at Indiana University at the Gary campus. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you share with our listeners this concept of intersectionality and its meaning for social change and human rights?
Well, it's very complex. It's much more complex than it might appear on the face, but yeah, I'll take a stab at it. And intersectionality actually emerges in the 1960s and 70s, primarily from the lived experiences and the resistance strivings of women of color in the United States. And it emerges as a result of the fact that historically, women of color from a number of different groups have always found themselves having to fight multiple forms of discrimination and oppression in their daily lives. And no matter what the group, what we've seen is that women have time and time again in their efforts to try to struggle against these forms of oppression and discrimination, that in one way or another they have been blocked. Their contributions have been downplayed. They have been denied. Their voices have been denied. And so we see in one of the most intense periods of struggle, that being the 60s and the 70s in this country, women of color reached a point where they began to say, you know, we're the only ones really who are trying to speak for our experiences based on all the things that we're up against. And so we have to speak for ourselves in a very clear kind of way. It's not to say that women of color have not always spoken for themselves, but I think we find in the 60s and the 70s probably one of the most clearest articulations and most sustained articulations of what has become known as this intersectional approach. The intersectional approach essentially says, as the Combahee River Collective said, that we have to address all the forms of discrimination and oppression that we are experiencing. And what they had realized was that everything that they were experiencing with respect to race was also connected to things they were experiencing with respect to class, gender, sexuality, etc. And so a piecemeal approach, an effort that only looked at race, an effort that only attempted to look at matters of class, an effort that only looked at matters of sexuality, ultimately resulted in an incomplete vision of what was happening to them and an incomplete vision of what they needed to be trying to do.
So how does this framework, this way of approaching oppression, how does that relate to the human rights ideal?
Here's one particular way in which it relates. Historically, when we look at the striving of women of color, what we see time and time again is that when they've been involved in social movements, while they've made major contributions, at the same time they have been constrained by the narrow way of understanding things, the narrow way of trying to advance reforms within those various movements in which they have been active. And in one way or another, there's always been some human rights violations that have been going on, particularly in the experience of the women of color. So when we talk about intersectionality, one of the first things we have to acknowledge is that women of color have said, listen, these are the people we are when we come in the room. These are the forms of discrimination that we are experiencing. You cannot tell us that one is any more important than the other. And so this kind of intersection of oppression derives from the fact that there is this need to understand all the various kinds of human rights violations that people are actually experiencing without privileging some over others.
Well, we want to thank you for that that brief but very thorough analysis, and we're going to explore this subject matter more as we have shared with our listeners that this is a framework that we believe has to center the human rights struggle here in this country and really worldwide. So thank you again, Professor Iverson, and we will be speaking to you again at some other point.
Thank you for having me.
And we're here this afternoon with Radhika Balakrishna, who is a full professor in economics and international studies at Marymount Manhattan College in New York. Radhika, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
I'm happy to be here.
We have heard a lot about the financial meltdown over the last week and a half, and we've got...
Right? This was an explicit policy of neoliberal economic policy, and lots of the kind of safeguards that would protect the sense of what the implications...
...financial meltdown over the last week and a half, and we've got... we've had a number of people to question just what does all this mean in terms of a human rights agenda for the next administration?
Well, I think there's several ways to look at it. I think one of the things that we need to focus on is to have a human rights lens to look at macroeconomic policy so that when they talk about Federal Reserve policy and they talk about these bailouts, that we as human rights defenders and activists have a clear sense of what the implications are for this, right? So one of the things that's taking place, and everyone's talking about this, is that we're now at a new moment in terms of economic policy, in terms of what the role of government is in managing the craziness of the market economy, right? The reason for this financial meltdown is because of the deregulation policy of the financial sector that's taken place over the last 28 years. Right? This was an explicit policy of neoliberal economic policy, and lots of the kind of safeguards that would protect the public have been taken away, and therefore we now are suffering from the problems of a casino economy that has, you know, created this incredible mess. So in terms of human rights, there are two things. One is that we as human rights people need to be able to assess macroeconomic policy, federal and fiscal policy. The other part is that when they talk about the re-regulation of the market and, you know, the Bush administration, McCain, Obama, all of them are talking about how the government needs to get involved in regulating the financial sector, I think we need to grab this moment. It's a historic moment because we're rethinking the role of the state. And I think as human rights people, we talk a lot about the role of the state. And so what is the role of the state in protecting the people, not just the market that's failed, but protecting the people that have been failed by the market, right? I mean, who is talking about the woman who was cleaning Lehman Brothers' floors? What kind of job is she going to get? What kind of unemployment compensation is she going to get? What kind of health insurance is she going to get? What are the human rights implications of the job loss of the people that are suffering from this? I mean, all the conversation is how to limit, you know, executive compensation so that they don't walk away with $24 million after they sort of ruin the company. But not enough people are talking about the poor people who are going to be affected by this. And we, and I think human rights is like the most, it's one of the most amazing times for us as human rights activists and defenders to go back and say, okay, you're all rethinking the role of the state. We have our own input into how the state needs to go. And the state's primary obligation is to take care of the people that live in the country. So that I think, is one of the sort of, for us to grab onto a critical moment.
That's a very interesting analysis, Radhika, because your conversation about, you know, reintroducing a conversation around the role of the state, it has implications connected to the role of democracy, because, of course, the question is whose state,
yeah,
and whose interests are being represented by the state.
Yeah.
So it also suggests, too, that if the state has a role to play, then there's also a connection between state activity, human rights, and social justice.
Absolutely.
What are some of the things that we could do with that $700 billion that is now going to be transferred to Wall Street in terms of addressing some of the ongoing issues that people are facing in this country that has an impact on their ability to live a dignified life? Just some examples of what we can do.
Before I give you that example, there's one more thing that I want to say,
okay,
about the $700 million, because this is really, really important.
Billion, yes.
Billion, sorry. I can't wrap my head around that kind,
exactly,
of number. But the issue, the concept and norm in human rights of transparency and accountability needs to be used in terms of how this transfer of money is going to take place. Because one of the things that this administration is doing is saying not only are they going to transfer this $800 billion to rescue the financial sector, but they're going to take the responsibility and governance of it into the executive branch with no accountability to the people, not even accountability to Congress, right? So the idea of transparency and accountability, which is enshrined in human rights, is not being used, and I think we as advocates need to ask for that and cry for it right now before it happens, right? I mean, Congress is starting to talk about it, and they're only talking about it in terms of, you know, grab for power and executive compensation, but I think we need to say that there needs to be a public ability of public to be able to scrutinize how this money is being spent, who it's being spent for, and for what reason.
And what are those human rights principles?
Transparency and accountability.
Transparency and accountability, okay.
Right? And now in terms of what this money can do, well, this money can pay for health care for all the people in this country. It can enhance education funding, which we know that how poorly education is funded in this country. We can 13% of the public in this country are nutritionally, they're inadequate, they're getting inadequate nutrition. 13%, that's a huge amount of people who are going to bed hungry. Now, what can $800 billion do for that? So I go back to my moment of talking about the reassertion of the role of the state. The reassertion of the role of the state can't just be to regulate these runaway markets that went and gambled all our livelihoods and are actually walking away with millions of dollars. But we need to reassert the role of the state in terms of taking care of the entitlements, the rights that we have to the right to food, the right to education, the right to health, the right to work. Again, the right to work, because that's also part of the human rights obligation, and that the state needs to go back to looking at these rights as the inherent role that they have in terms of what they do. As you know, it's not just sort of regulating the market, but it's also, you know, protecting the people to the avarice of the market, which is what we're all seeing, right? It's just the absolute greed of the market that's gotten us into this crisis.
You know, there seems to be two other principles that may be in play here, two other human rights principles, and that is the principle of effective participation and the principle related to the right to information.
Yeah.
Are we getting the information that we need in order to properly assess what is taking place in Congress these next few days around this bailout?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm reading like crazy everything I can. I mean, Congress isn't getting the information. I mean, forget the public.
Mm.
And in their hurry to try and get this through, because we're dealing with this global disaster and the world will go into a global recession, they're also trying to push through other things. I mean, the Patriot Act is a great example of how they push through a heinous human rights, anti-human rights document, in the sense that there's an urgency. And, I mean, there is an urgency in some ways for the markets failing, but, you know, the urgency cannot be used as a way to pull something off that gives the executive branch more power than it's ever had. And an executive branch like this, do we want to, like, fall asleep and give them this amount of power with no checks and balances? I don't think so.
This raises one final question, and it's probably not the kind of question to raise in just a few seconds that we have left, but this does call into question the degree in which a market economy can really address the objective needs of people, the objective human rights needs of people in any society, doesn't that?
It does. I mean, especially an incredibly unregulated market economy. I mean, the one thing that I think after the Depression that came very clear is that if we're going to stick with a market economy, it needs to be very well regulated and managed by government. And, you know, since the late 70s, early 80s, that idea that we need a regulated market has sort of disappeared, and to a point where we're starting, I mean, there were so many bubbles, right, and this is the biggest one, and it's crashing. So, yeah, is the market economy work at all? That's a larger question. I think maybe we could have a much longer conversation about that. But given that we have a market economy, and even the pro-marketeers are talking about why we need to regulate it, I think this is the time for us working on human rights to talk about how we want it re-regulated, and not just regulating the financial sector, but regulating all the sectors so that the needs and the rights of people are the forefront of state policy, and not sort of just mitigating the problems of what happens when there's a crisis.
Dr. Balakrishnan, this has been a very informative discussion. I'm sure that there's a lot that our listeners can take away from this conversation, and we would like to thank you for being here.
And thank you, U.S. Human Rights Network, for doing all the work that you do.
Underlying all human rights work in the United States is a commitment to challenge a belief that the United States is inherently superior to other countries of the world, and that neither the U.S. government nor the U.S. rights movement have anything to gain from the domestic application of human rights. Network members believe that the U.S. government should no longer be allowed to shield itself from accountability to human rights norms, and that the U.S. civil, disability, women's, workers, immigrant, LGBTQ, prisoner impunity, and other rights movements that stand to benefit perhaps now more than ever from an end to U.S. impunity in this regard. For more information on how to join the U.S. Human Rights Network, visit us online at www.ushrnetwork.org. Human Rights No Retreat, No Compromise podcast is a production of the U.S. Human Rights Network, produced by Ajamu Baraka, Sunyata Altenor, and Genevieve Williams, with Sugar Matthews, Tonya Williams, Drina Brown, Kalia Kunu, and Rachel Fowler. U.S. Human Rights Network at www.ushrnetwork.org.
In its wake, Katrina left a ravaged Gulf Coast and a nation shocked by the images of poverty and neglect that it revealed.
To the extent that the federal government didn't fully do its job right, I take responsibility. And it was